Hello and welcome to this very first episode of Safety Sisters, the podcast about the people who keep you safe. In this very first episode, I interview Katie Sonnen. Katie is the CEO of Invictus Professional Training, training for security and medical in events and in all walks of life. Katie has worked in the event security and medical industry for almost 20 years, and she is the first guest for the very reason that she helped me come up with the name Safety Sisters. We wanted to talk about and celebrate the women and the people in our industry who work tirelessly behind the scenes to keep everyone safe. And I want to take this opportunity in this podcast to celebrate these people, celebrate what they have to offer, and share their wisdom, their experience and their knowledge with others in the industry to make sure that we do our best to keep people safe at events and beyond. This episode is a roller coaster. Katie has an incredible background and life experience that she shared with me, and I really hope you enjoy this one. And some very unusual experiences that she has had that actually helped her in her professional life. So sit back, relax, and I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did. Welcome, Katie. This is the first interview. I'm so excited. I want to hear what you do today. And I want to hear how you got to what made you, what inspired you to do what you do.
So I am a full-time PhD student with the Centre for Trust, Peace and Social Relations at the University of Coventry. I've been doing that for 4 months now, 5 months now. So I am still essentially a PhD baby. The official subject area is the behavioural science of protective security. So that was pretty wide ranging. So I've chosen to look at effectively like the perceptions of safety within large music events. So very broadly, are people at large music events as safe as they think they are? So. Yeah. And then I'm hopefully going to have a particular slant on terrorism as well, because not just because it's a hot topic at the moment, obviously with new legislation, but it sounds terrible. It is a particular interest of mine. So I did psychology and criminology at uni for my degree, and that, like, it's always the weirdos, you know. I shouldn't call them weirdos, but
interesting, you know, people.
The not typical, the atypicals, they're always the ones that are slightly more interesting. So I thought, you know what, if I can combine my years of security in crowds with my interest in terrorism and spend 3 years just totally immersed in researching that, then boom, like, why wouldn't you do that? There's probably everyone out there going, why the hell would you? But, you know, it's not a serious topic.
What was the sort of driving factor of this is why I want to do this?
So it's purely selfish. I mean, I can see that going forward it can have, you know, my findings, my research will have quite interesting applications for events and for venues. But kind of during lockdown, obviously everything stopped and we all had a bit of a panic, and then people started putting on more educational events, so talks and webinars and courses, and I started doing a couple of those, and I suddenly realized that actually I haven't really been using my brain very much. You know, I've been kind of running on autopilot and learning bits here and there, but I haven't really been stretching it a huge amount, and I really enjoy it. So I was like, following that, I'd already had a couple of conversations with some lecturers, just sort of like whilst working graduations and things, and going, oh, you know, I'd love to do a PhD, but I don't really want to do a master's. And this one guy went, well, why then? Why do a master's if you don't really want to? And I was like, well, I thought you had to. And he was like, no. So that kind of sparked a little bit of intrigue. And then, yeah, lockdown sort of rekindled my love of learning.
Your career to date has kind of gone down many different tracks. Can you sort of briefly
take us down that path of how your career started and how it evolved and all the different things that you've done or your kind of highlights.
Yeah, so I graduated 2006 with dual honours, psychology and criminology, with absolutely no idea what I wanted to do. I hadn't chosen that course because it was what I was in, like what I wanted to do with any particular aspirational aims. It was just something I thought would keep me interested while I was at uni for those 3 years. Considered sort of the prison service, again, working with unusual people, sort of the psychology side of the prison service. But thought, well, let's just see what happens. So weirdly went and worked for England Rugby for a bit, because that was another huge passion of mine, rugby. So
and what did you do then, at England Rugby?
I was doing promotions and events. So I was do you know what, it was brilliant. I was organising touch games, like pitch up and play touch games on beaches.
I mean, what a great job to start with out of university.
Oh yeah, no, it's cracking. I just drove around, followed Zap Cats, that are these twin hulled motor boats or race like little ribs that are absolutely insane. So I was following their tour around as part of their tour, and yeah, playing rugby and chilling and going out on speedboats. It was a very tough life. Oh nice. God, it was awful.
Not, I wonder how linked that is to psychology, but I mean, it's a nice start. So how did that then evolve into security and everything else?
Well, so I had a little bit of student loan left over, and I'd kind of thought
you had money left over?
I know. I don't quite know how. I did try my hardest to spend it. I'm obviously just too good at budgeting. It sounds weird. Like when I'd go out a lot when I was at school, as in go out nightclubbing. But I kind of realised, it's going to sound really awful, I realised it took me a lot to get drunk. So therefore, my nights out were really expensive. And I've discovered that actually I could have just as good a time if I had Haribo and Coca-Cola for my night, and I'd still be bouncing off the walls, but I could drive home. So, and obviously save a load of money. So the issue with that would be that obviously I was the sober one. So when you're seeing people like girls collapsing the toilets or whatever, I was the one that was then going and telling security. So I kind of had this like informal relationship with a lot of the door staff in various nightclubs. So they'd go in, they'd ask me, you know, to do some toilet checks and stuff for them. I then had a conversation with them and they were like, you know, you should think about doing this because there's a massive shortage of women in the security industry. So I took my leftover student loan and I booked onto a door supervisor course, and at the end of that I felt more unprepared for working on the doors than I did beforehand. It was terrifying, but I was like, well, you know, at the time £10 an hour, that was pretty good money, you know, back in the olden days. So one of the tutors from my course actually was like, I run a security company, I'd love you to come work for us. So did that. Turned out I wasn't that bad, which was quite surprising. So that was me full time for a bit. First woman to have a single door, if that makes sense. So like a one person team.
Yeah.
First woman to be like promoted to head door supervisor
in your company that you worked in.
In my company.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
First woman to be like promoted to overnight manager, and to then run like the beach security teams. So yeah, had some quite fun times there.
That's incredible, Katie. Those are huge achievements. So how old were you at this stage? Was this
22, 23?
Wow. So pretty early on in your career and hitting all of these amazing that's incredible.
Yeah it was pretty good at the time. You know, you'd have people, because that was all nightclubs, so predominantly nightclubs and bars, and then, you know, I'd get sent people to train up, like new door supervisors to train up, which was quite funny really, because again I was just kind of making it up as I went as well. And you get, you know, you get kind of the seasoned guys who'd be like, oh, you know, you should come and do festivals. And I was like, why the hell would I want to do that? That sounds horrific. And they're like, oh no, it's like, you know, 12-hour shift.
What sounds horrific about it? Crowds?
Oh god. I wasn't that bothered about crowds at that point. Just kind of like the conditions. And I remember one guy trying to convince me that, you know, Reading and Leeds was a good idea. And this other woman was like, oh yeah, it's brilliant. You know, we do campsites on the Sunday night and people set their gas canisters on fire and throw them at us. And I was like, why the hell would you want to do that? Like, why would you, why, if you've got the option to not go and do that, why would you? Like, that's insane. So I was like, yeah, I'm quite happy going home to my nice, comfy, warm bed every night.
Yeah.
Kind of avoided festivals, like large-scale festivals as much as possible. Until I joined quite a prolific security company. Again, I'd put off joining them for years, but it kind of got to the point where it was almost inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And part of their conditions was basically for supervisors. So again, I got pushed up to supervisor within, it was about 4 months. And my first ever festival was Bestival in 2012. Still very new to festivals in the whole. I'd had no supervisor training with this company. I'd never really seen crowds that big. I'd been I've been as a customer to one festival. I went to V Festival in like 2005. So then suddenly they were like, here you go, here's two arenas to look after. I was like, wow. Cool story, bro.
Huge amount of responsibility with no training, or, and did you get support? I mean, and
not really. Like, there was supposed to be another supervisor looking after one area, but he just kind of bailed. So I just kind of got left with his area as well, which is how I ended up with two. I did only start with one, but ended up with two. And obviously all these teams have pretty experienced security. And I'd like to say I smashed it. So, you know, the comments from the minibus drivers, it's quite a big site, the minibus drivers on the way back, they were like, what are you doing to your team? And I was like, oh my god, what do you mean? And they went, your team are all really happy at the end of the shift.
I was like
isn't everyone? So they're like, no, usually they're all proper miserable. And I was like, oh. So then it was great because I then had staff retention. I had the same team wanting and kind of like stealing wristbands, which, you know, is bad, but they were stealing wristbands to get back to my area.
Wow.
And I had response teams lurking in my area rather than, you know, elsewhere where they should have been, just because they knew that I'd be walking around and I'd have sweets and I'd stop and have a chat and explain stuff and I'd always be
and treat them like human.
But to me that was just, you know, part of it. Like, it wasn't a special effort, it was just how I thought the job should have been done. So and then from there kind of moved through things, got into teaching. So I started with teaching first aid. Again, because I was managing up.
How did you get into teaching first aid?
So I feel like your mind's going to be slightly blown. So 2012 was kind of like a pivotal year. So 2011 to 2012, I was like, right, I need to take some time out for me. I need to go and figure out who I am, what I want to do, where I'm going in my life, you know. So my friend lives on a cattle farm, or she owns a cattle farm with her husband out in Australia.
Okay.
So she was like, oh, come over. So I was like, cool, all right. Booked a ticket and did that. So I was a cowgirl for 3 months.
which is amazing.
Yeah, it was quite fun. And actually, people are like, oh, well, how's that related? Do you know what? I think I've learned the most from around crowd management, and I'll probably get loads of backlash going.
You're gonna have to talk me through this one.
Well, you know, you've got a herd of cows. Yeah. You've got a herd of cows, and they're just like people. They work the same way as people. So, you know, when you're doing things like an arena sweep. If you put a member of staff at the front and try and sweep people towards them, either they will turn round because they don't want to go that way, they will go around them, they will pop out the sides because you're putting too much pressure on them and you're essentially blocking the exit.
Yeah.
So, which is exactly the same with cows.
This is real. I knew I was going to get a gem from you.
So I've seen it in action. So we've had to do, like, I've had to watch pitch clearances from sporting games where you've had loads of people coming on the pitch and we've then had to clear them. And you see the security moving and herding them, because that's essentially what you're doing. You're herding people because you want them to go into a specific place or a specific location. So you start herding them, and then you'll get this one security officer who, I don't know what they're doing, but they then go and stand right in the wrong place, exactly, you know, like you'd get with a really inexperienced herding dog or person. They'll go and stand in the wrong place, at which point your nice, neat herd then fractures, and you get that first person who goes the wrong way, that first runner. And if you don't kind of corral them, then your entire herd will just fracture. So watching security teams struggling with this really basic concept, and they're kind of, you can see them standing there looking at each other going, why is it not working? And you're like, because that one person is in the wrong place. Just that one person. Move him, this crowd will move like water. It'll be beautiful. But while he's there, your crowd will be getting more anxious. They're crowded in one place. They're not moving. They're not happy.
And they're not exiting.
Yeah, they're not doing what you want. They're not doing what you want, and they're also not doing what they want, because they, if they're there, they generally don't want to necessarily stay there. They want to move somewhere, and they're not in a comfortable position. But you're kind of, even though you're not physically stopping them, just essentially the psychological impact of having that person in the wrong place will prevent people from walking past. So
crowds are like cows.
Yep, cow crowd.
And any other kind of, is that sort of the kind of major, the biggest thing that you picked up, or were there any other insights?
Oh, stay away from all snakes. That was quite a key one. Roma cows. So yeah, Roma cattle. Wow, they are crazy. Like, absolutely crazy. Do not go in there by yourself, and if you do not go in there without a bit of hose and being able to jump the fence. That is my cow advice. And actually, okay, it's a lot easier to castrate than you might think it is.
Well, anyone listening, you came here for crowds and you got cows.
Is that not what we're talking about?
I love
it. Oh, man.
So
I thought this would go by monthly. Wow.
So you started off saying you started teaching first aid, and then we got to cows. How does this now come back to the first aid?
Okay, so I then came back from Cowland and started working for the large company. So I worked kind of all over the south, and then a particular venue in Portsmouth was changing the way they did security. So they were looking for some full-time concierge staff. So I applied, got that job. Also meant I moved up to Portsmouth. They put me on a first aid course. While I was there, the guy went, "You're pretty good." And I was like, "Well, I've been doing first aid for a while, mainly on myself, but been doing this training for and ages." Yeah. And cows. No, first aid from the cows. That was the issue. So he said, "Oh, have you ever thought about being a medic?" And I was like, "Not really." So he said, "Well, I'm running an event medic company, so come join that." So I was like, "Okay, why not? Extra cash." So I had my full-time job, security, and then I added medic in on the side as well. Great diary management. And then from that, he was like, "Oh, we need a manager." So I was like, "Oh, okay." And in the interim, I'd left the concierge role. So he was like, "Oh, come and manage my company for me." So I was like, "All right." And then he was like, "Wow, I'm doing loads of training. We've got getting loads of extra work in. Come and teach first aid." Okay. So that kind of got to that point. So I did that for a bit. At which point Carl's business, he'd kind of been through his own stuff.
Your husband.
My husband, and he had decided to focus on his business, so doing sort of essentially safety and specialist security training. So I was like, "Well, I could do that. You know, I've got a bit of experience. Give it a go." Yeah. So I jumped in on his business, and here we are.
And so with this company then, does the work that you do, or the work that you do that's now on pause, does that take in all of your previous experience?
To a point, I'm going to name drop Invictus Professional Training Limited. We're here for all your security needs. Sorry, you got radio voice there.
That was brilliant.
Oh, God. Oh, it was awful. So obviously we do like all the mandatory sort of health and safety, first aid, all that side.
For events or for any business?
Any business.
Yeah.
We try and tailor it depending on who our clients are. So if we're delivering to a security company, we'll include catastrophic bleeding because it's important. But if we're delivering to like a nursing home, then we'll think about actually what are the real risks that they're facing, what sort of home is it. So that's side. Then we do obviously all the security license linked qualifications, so door supervisor, security officer, and CCTV. We don't do close protection because it's not our area of expertise. There's a lot of really great companies out there doing it, so I'd much rather send them to someone else, to be honest. And then we do a lot of sort of like post-license upskilling and qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
So things like incident response team, front of stage barrier, so like lifting people over pits, supervisor training, pit supervisor training, which is quite fun. Yeah. Reporting, recording, control room. Yeah. If we can't do it, we're quite happy to hold our hands up. We don't do everything. We don't have expertise in everything from our trainer team. But generally, if we can't do it, then we'll know someone really good who will.
Yeah.
Or who can. And, there's no point us half-assing a job. I'd much rather just pass it on to someone else.
Yeah. And tell me about these, so the post-qualification training, so like the supervisor, pit crew, pit supervisors, so pit being the space between the barrier and the stage, but I assume that everyone listening to this works in events, so like one of my kind of interests and hats is the whole sort of licensing and regulation and the fact that for most of our industry there is none. So you're kind of thrown into these really important jobs without any kind of training or qualification. And these courses that you've just listed, these roles are so important and so specialist.
So there is a qualification for front of stage barrier.
Yeah.
But we have opted not to deliver it, if that makes sense. So we deliver our own front stage barrier course and issue certification for that. And the reason for that is purely we used to, both of us individually used to deliver the qualification.
Yeah.
And it's very, very like history based. There's a lot of sort of the academic side, whereas a pit, I don't think necessarily needs to be that level of understanding the like origins of a front of stage barrier. In 1960 the pit would sit below. I mean, that's great. It's great if you want to find out, but actually,
can you call someone out of the crowd when you need to and say
that's the important bit? Yeah. So recognizing what normal crowd behavior looks like, recognizing what abnormal crowd behavior looks like, current trends as well. So when we get weird and wonderful stuff like the earthquake that came out of nowhere, that was great.
Tell me more.
The earthquake, we have like it's generally, I can't remember which DJ it is, I started at a DEFCON, I think, where they're like, right, everyone link arms and take like four jumps to the left, 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 to the right, 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 and you just see how many hundreds of thousands of people bouncing along, which phenomenal to watch. Absolutely phenomenal to watch. Probably quite amazing to be in,
mm-hmm.
from a crowd management viewpoint. Blech. That's my technical term right there.
And
it does not feel me.
And for those of us who may not work in crowd management but work in other areas of events, translate what is when it happens in real life. How it impacts you, I guess, as your role.
Yeah, just I think the recognition of it just takes one person in that to fall over, and that entire crowd could go down, and then you're talking about hundreds of injuries, because it's not easy to get up from that. Like, any large crowd collapse is just not easy to get up from, and especially if they're all linked together to start with. So yeah, just that horrible feeling of unease.
And have you ever had
a very typical term.
And have you ever had that experience of any sort of kind of collapse where you it was challenging for you and your team, or the team that was there, to be able to help, to be able to mitigate and resolve the issue?
We've had some little ones. I think it'd be, you know, ridiculous to say that as a venue or as a individual that you've never experienced anything. We've had, I think, in various venues that I've worked with, there have been challenges. We've had small little crowd collapses. There've been some larger progressive crowd collapses that I was there for, didn't see personally, but watched the videos afterwards, just because of where I was at the time. But there's a difference between having all those free agents, essentially, having people being able to not be interconnected and move around freely and stabilize themselves. But as soon as you connect them together, then I think, for me anyway, like, the possibility is massively increased, or the impact is increased.
And with events kind of today, or in the, you know, kind of post-pandemic, are there kind of other that you are seeing happen that is a cause for concern from your experience?
Oh God, everything's a cause for concern.
Crowds are a cause for concern.
Yeah.
They're
just
very
people in general. If we could do events with no audiences, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
But not very profitable.
No. So.
Maybe this is why I'm not.
We also wouldn't be there. We wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Someone would be like, that's what tabletops are for. So there seems to have been a bit of a change in, like, mosh pits.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're seeing a bit more, like, a higher level of aggression and intentional wounding and hurting that wasn't necessarily there before. And
of the crowd to each other? Or of the crowd towards security, of the crowd to each other,
The crowd to each other, so within, like, the actual mosh pit itself.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably just, well, partly down to lack of experience. So if you've got people who haven't been, you know, generally with mosh pits, you grow up, you learn how the mosh pit works. You don't kind of blast in on your first one and start throwing your arms around. Mm. You maybe kind of see what happens, see what the social norms are, then get involved, and you learn fairly quickly. It's a fairly self-regulated area.
Mm.
Personally, anyway, it seems at the moment that there's, like, a higher level of crowd killing and, yeah, like, intentional aggressiveness, rather than, you know, the kind of free expression and, like, chaotic dancing.
Yeah, that is usually associated with moshing. Yeah.
So that's something that we've had to kind of keep an eye on, and also it can be quite dangerous, like, not dangerous, can be quite difficult to manage as well, because there's a really fine line between people punching each other in the face for fun, and it kind of being consensual and everyone being happy, and one guy punching another guy in the face. Bizarre. And, you know, the puncher having a great time, but actually the person being hit kind of not being up for that.
Yeah.
Which, you know, if you take that out of the mosh pit, that's assault, it's an arrestable offence.
Yeah.
Bosh, you know, done. But because it's in a mosh pit, it's within, you know, the social norms of the mosh pit. But then also you've kind of got the, well, you know, why he wants to express himself and he's come here specifically to release that energy and have a good time. And his having a good time is impacting on other people. But then who says that other people's right to enjoyment is more important than his? So then you're kind of faced with, like, the one versus the many. So, you know, obviously punching people in the face is unacceptable, but even things like, you know, large dancing, you've got people trying to start crowd surges. So they'll literally, like, run into a harder body to crowd, to just to try and get that movement going, which again, it's not acceptable, but it's also not, like, it's not criminal behavior, it's just unacceptable behavior, if that makes sense.
Within the societal norms, within the the psychological
So generally, you know, you talk to people, you make them aware, you tell them, you know, clearly their level of energy is way above what everyone else is doing, and maybe they just need a bit more space or to just tailor their behavior slightly. But it is kind of difficult, because why should one person be tailoring their behavior? You know, if you've got one person singing their heart out, having the absolute best time, but it's ruining it for other people, then why does everyone else's enjoyment count for more than that one person? Which is kind of difficult, and kind of, I think, probably leads to, like, thinking about what happened in, I want to say Manchester, was it the Bodyguard? I don't think it was Manchester, actually.
Oh, the theatre audiences.
Yeah.
I can't remember what city was it. Yeah, but it was, it was the Bodyguard theatre show. And, yeah, continue.
Oh, yeah, so you've got people singing along, having a great time, but then other people complaining because they couldn't hear the singing. And, you know, both people are enjoying, but it's just different, like, the different expectations. And again, I think that's kind of come out of it as well.
Yeah, when does it cross that threshold of what's acceptable and what's not, in what situation? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, these are, like, they're kind of the eternal question, isn't it? And it's you know, when you're in that environment and you're managing that environment and you're going, when, like, the, like, it's almost like you're watching it and it's like the only way you can respond is by your gut feeling going, okay, this is starting to kind of escalate. Do I need to interject now? Is it going to die down by itself? Is this now unacceptable behavior? And it's not black or white at all, actually. And I guess that's the challenge with humans, is we are humans and we have this ability to make all these different decisions at any one time. And so, yeah, thank you for that insight. I guess my kind of, one of my final questions is, what would you like to see change or improve that just makes the industry a better place to be in?
I think if everyone's egos fell off, then the industry would I think the industry would be massively improved. Just because I find that they get in the way. So I'm not saying they're necessarily bad things, but they do get in the way. And, like, especially when you then have this, like, perceived hierarchy between like different groups, like all the different groups that make up an event, there is, well, yeah, other people may disagree, but I definitely think there is a perceived hierarchy. So you kind of have, like, your security, and then below that you've got your stewards. I think possibly slightly above that you've got medical riggers. So riggers, crew, kind of, I think everyone will have a different idea of where their own industry or work group sits within that hierarchy. But I think they tend to get shoved fairly low down the bottom. And then at the top, you've got sort of, like, definitely the police. The police always seem to be at the top of everything, which is frustrating, incredibly frustrating. Obviously, depending on the individuals, but yeah, sometimes kind of that recognition that actually other people may know more than you, other people specialize in different things, and this perceived hierarchy isn't helpful. So when you've suddenly got, you know, medics kind of lording it up and assuming that they can do whatever they want because they're wearing a medic uniform, and kind of, you know, they can take breaks when they want, and rubbing that into security's face, they're very, very different job roles. It's just frustrating and unnecessary, but I think it just gets perpetuated as well. That's probably not the answer. Please delete all of that.
No, do you know what? You're saying something that I've actually been thinking about this last while, that I've just noticed, like the egos and yeah, that perception of hierarchy and like, I know better than you. And actually that egotistical approach, and coming from that perspective, from that kind of triggered ego perspective, increases risk to safety of the audience. Because the police will come in, as you say, and, you know, not bashing the police or anything, but like, let's say the police come in and go, well, I know this and you don't. It's like, yeah, but I'm a crowd safety professional and I've been working in crowd safety for blah, blah, blah. Okay, what do I know? And I, you know, I'm the first.
Need to move this HVM just for fun.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know,
I'm so glad we spent hours designing it and working out the risk and doing all of that for you to just come along and move it because, you know, it's in the way for you and your van. Like, all right then.
Or you spend meetings and meetings with counterterrorism designing the HVM around your shuttle bus load zone, and then you show up and they've dropped the HVM right where the load zone loads people onto buses. And you're amazing. Like, how am I going to get my people onto buses now? And I even noticed as I kind of attack my own ego and challenge my own ego and try and focus on just doing the best job that I can, I do see that sort of like ego in other people, and how that sort of is almost the driver of them rather than like their desire to keep people safe being the driver. So you're touching on something very important. And also the attitude towards stewards and security is to me pretty inhumane as an industry. Oh, good, yeah. You know, we treat them less as human. We call them jacket fillers. We call them, I don't know, what other sort of insults. And it's like, hold on a second. We're paying these people pittance per hour. We're expecting them to smile, stand up for hours, deal with thousands of people who could be drunk and angry or drunk and angry. We need them to give directions, obviously know where the emergency exit are, be able to know what to do in an emergency, be able to direct people out, approach a suspect package, putting themselves at risk, approach a suspect person, putting themselves at risk. We want them to do all of this stuff, but then pay them very little amount. And then on top, treat them as such, treat them, you know, like they are less than. And this is something that I'm rattling my head of, like, how can we change this attitude? Because we're not giving these people the respect they deserve. And then because they're treated with this disdain, they're going to act up. They're going to act like, I don't want to be here. I don't care to be here because you don't treat me with respect. And then it just perpetuates the whole cycle. You know, it's like,
why should I go out and do extra qualifications and learn more when I'm not going to get paid anymore for it and I'm still going to get treated like poop? So, again, we still expect them to go out and, you know, the license linked qualifications, everyone complains about the PI, the physical intervention.
Yeah.
But it's not designed to be the only course that someone undertakes. It's designed to be a general base level for people to then go on and upskill.
Yeah.
And like you said, like the whole inhumane thing, you know, I've worked build and break shifts where, you know, you're on overnight, so you're doing 12, 14, 16 hours overnight. And, you know, it's a moment of celebration on like day four when the portaloo's delivered.
Mm.
Because, you know, up until that point, you've been going in a bush. And, you know, you're going to the toilet in a bush and you're finding people dogging, you know, it's unbelievable. Or you're there sat in your car, you know, by yourself, with a radio that may or may not work, possibly got a team, possibly not. And you kind of think, you know, are we doing enough? Are we doing enough in terms of welfare? Are we doing enough in terms of like lone working and making sure that they're okay? And then, you know, you drive around. I've been the person who drives around and catches people asleep. And yeah, at the time it was really frustrating. But looking back, you think, well, yeah, fair enough. Like, they're probably working day shifts as well.
Yeah. Yeah. because we're not paying them enough, and we don't even give, like, just, I mean, we all know what it's like to not be given the basic level of respect of not being fed and not being able to go to the toilet. Once again, these are like basic human rights and necessities, and we're not,
they are human rights,
yeah, like we're not being given them working on an event. So, you know, like, I would just walk away now. I wouldn't stay for it, but like, I, you know, I wouldn't have before. I would have put up with all these different levels of crap, basically, to be able to, I mean, I don't know why, pay for, you know, be able to earn the money that I was earning. But yeah, we put up with so much, and that's why I really just dislike about this industry, and I want it to change, is that we need to respect everyone, and we need to treat them with the respect they deserve, and we need to pay them properly, feed them properly, welfare them properly, and put the right trained people in the right positions. Yeah, and it is difficult because events take a lot of human resource. Like, there's a lot of stewarding that's needed. And, you know, if we can, like, I always look at when we design the crowd safety plan is like, design out the problem, as design out, you know, the risks as much as possible. And then the last layer that goes in are the humans, because you want, the less humans you put in, the less risk to them as well, you know, that you're putting everyone at risk that is in the crowd. So it's, yeah, I haven't found a solution yet, apart from accepting that we need to up the budgets. And for some reason, seeing security not as a cost, but as the reason the event can go ahead, you know.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's just so frustrating, you know. And you get security, I think the companies are just as guilty, if that makes sense, because but quite a lot of them, you do just get treated like a number, you know. You are number whatever. And because you're not an employee, because you're a subcontractor, actually they've got no requirements to provide you with a toilet or to provide you with food. And because, you know, one of the first things that happens when you join a security company is you're asked to sign, obviously it'll be different now because we're out of the EU, but you get asked to sign out of the EU working time directive, meaning that you can work, you know, infinite, all the time if you want. So it's just, I think if companies take more responsibility, you know, essentially the better you teach your staff, or the better you treat your staff, the longer and more loyal they'll be. So why aren't we treating them all better?
Good question. And that is the challenge to the industry. But we do need to raise awareness, you know. And I think there's a lot of people, I guess we don't know it, we don't know that as an industry we're doing it to ourselves. Like, we're causing,
and there's a lot of acceptance.
And even, like, I was talking to one event organizer, and she was like, why are security always like this and blah blah, and I was like, well, if you plan your event, don't bring in the security plan until last minute, then bring in the security plan, you're giving them no time to plan, no time to put in good measures, no time to get the right staff that they need, the best staff. And then she goes, so actually we're part of the problem. I was like, yes, thank you.
Like, I don't want to say it, but yes, you are.
The earlier you bring in the crowd safety element, actually, like, it's like, the event needs to be designed in threaded with crowd safety, because the event brings crowds. Crowd safety is the, you know, and then you, so you get this team in to, as you to design your event. And then all of a sudden you've got event infrastructure, event schedules, event access that is conducive to supporting crowd safety. And then also you get to book in all the staff needed earlier on. You know, they're briefed better, they're trained better, it just makes it for a better event, and actually then more cost effective, because you're not having to then get in so many staff because of all these errors made in the design of the event, you know. So actually it's a cost saving, it saves on cost, and I don't think people really understand that too well.
I was reading something, funnily enough, the other day, and it was, I can't remember exactly where. When I find it, I'll send it to you. But it was basically saying that on a multi-day event, so like a festival, It's common for up to 20% of security staff to walk off after day one.
Wow, that's a big number.
Yeah. And it's also a big number that I don't think kind of gets passed up.
Yeah.
So now you think, so the security companies are inflating their numbers in order to cover that shortfall.
Yeah.
And they'll have done that in advance. But actually, like you said, if you were training people and treating people better, then if we could get that down to like 5%, you're always going to have walk-off.
Yeah.
It's always going to happen. If you could get that down to 5%, 10%, then actually you're saving a fair amount of money because you're not paying people to be there just in case.
Yeah.
It just, I think a lot of the time you've got management going in who are very good managers, but haven't necessarily worked on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So they've never been at the bottom. And then you've got people coming up from ground level who are kind of super excited now because they're managing and they're amazing. And, you know, they kind of get the ego boost that way. But they also then kind of forget what it was like at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have one manager who at the end of, we'd have briefing, a debrief at the end of a shift. And pretty much everyone, he'd go, well, yeah, we survived that, didn't we? And you're like, what message is that saying to your staff? Mm. Like, and these are, you know, 2,500 person gigs. They're not, you know, they're all right. But, you know, if that's what you're saying, oh, yeah, well, we survived that. We were pretty lucky, weren't we? Well, what kind of planning did you have in place where you have to rely on luck?
Yeah.
For that to go okay? Jeez. Like,
that's not filling me with hope as if I'm, you know, one of those staff on the ground. It doesn't make me want to come in the next day and be part of a family or part of a team. Yeah, no, that's it doesn't get passed up because the security companies don't want to show that there's I'm quoting air quotes, quote unquote, failing. When it's not failing, it's like the amount, like, you know, when I've been on the side of booking security staff, I'm like, please be honest with me. What are your shortages? Please be honest with me. Because if you're honest with me, then I can go and change the plan to be able to. And they'll just go, yeah, no, we're fine. We're fine. And then the day comes where it's too late for me to change the plan and we're short. And it's like, if you had just been honest with me, and like, I really value that honesty because yes, it's vulnerability, but invulnerability is power because it's like, you know that you're not going to get in trouble. It's like I because the earlier you can tell me, we can work together to come up with a solution. And I think there's still that sort of like fear of shame or something with the security and stewarding providers to then turn to, you know, the crowd manager or the event organizer and go, actually, we've had 20% walk off. Like, they're not going to say that, are they? They're going to be like, everything's fine, all the positions are covered. And then we're walking around site going, why is there no one at the accessible viewing platform? Why is there no one, like, you know,
yes, there should be people here.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm sorry, this was on the dot plan. You know, and it has a huge impact because, you know, let's say you needed 9 lanes, you know, for your search and now you've only got 5, like that's going to change your plan, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like from the security and the stewarding companies to just be honest and, you know, and I guess it's for the whole industry because A, we want the security and stewarding companies to be honest, but then B, we want the clients to not eat their head off. We want the clients to go, thank you for being honest. Thank you for letting me know. Let's work together to come up with a solution. And that, once again, that is taking that ego right out of it, isn't it? Like, we just need to drop our egos and go, we're working on this together. And that is
one team, one love.
Yeah, 100%. Like, why do we need to be horrible to each other? And like, I do wonder, like, is, you know, with what I talk about with Naomi on the Meliorum Aventus, like the fact that we're under so much pressure, you know, if you see me after like a full night's sleep and a day off, or you see me after no night's sleep and working 12 hours, which one's going to be grumpy Issei? Which one's going to be happy Issei? You know, so if we're like under extreme pressure, it's almost like you've got this pressure gauge coming down. It's like the steam's going to spew out the sides and we're just going to attack each other and have a go at each other, and when we find one fault, attack the other person. So I think it's just this like evil cycle that because we're all exhausted, it's hard for us to be jubilant and happy because there are reserves, we're in fight or flight. So like, I see this as like a whole cyclical kind of thing. So
could you imagine if rather than doing like 12 or 18 hour shifts on a festival, everyone was doing like 7 or 8 hour shifts,
like a normal instead day. Like a normal day.
Like a normal quote day. But would it be a logistical nightmare? Yes, it would. Would it result in potentially better and safer events? Do you know what? Possibly. Because, you know, by the time it kind of gets to, if we're honest, when we're expecting the major issues or the biggest worries to happen, isn't, you know, right at the beginning. It's usually towards the end.
Yeah.
And when everybody is proper hanging out at that point, when actually they're needed the most, why aren't we taking those steps to prepare for that and almost like counteract it? And especially when you've got multi-days as well, you know, by day three, something happens, you know, headline set 10 to 11 on a Sunday night of a festival, would your response be exactly the same as it would have been at, you know, midday on the Friday? Possibly, but possibly not. And by response, I mean like your decision making. Would it be as fast? Would it be as accurate? Would it take into account as much? I don't know. And that's just in itself kind of concerning.
Yeah, I completely agree. And when we're exhausted, the evidence is out there, we don't make right decisions. And I keep referring back to this study. Which book was it in now? Thinking Fast and Slow, perhaps. Is it Daniel Kahneman's? And he talks about the study done on judges and when they're getting, what's that, when someone appeals to be released, what's that called, going on, what's that word?
Parole.
What?
Parole?
Yeah, when they get the people apply for parole, yeah, to be released early, and they read the application, you know, that they've been, you know, that they want to be released early. And they were studying all these judges about their decision making, and they found that after they ate, so after breakfast and after lunch, they were more likely to say yes. And when they were hungry, so just before lunch and then coming into the evening, like when they were getting tired, is when they were, their default like was no. So when we are rested and well fed and basically in our rest and digest, we can make better decisions because we're using our evolved brain. When we're tired and hungry, we default back to our primitive brain, and we make decisions from our fight or flight. So I completely agree with you. We're not putting ourselves in positions to be making the best decisions when we're that tired, and we're making decisions that impact the safety of thousands of people, including our staff.
Yay. And including us as well.
And including us. Yeah. So
yeah,
there's a lot that this industry needs to do to, I think, have a future, because we're just all going to burn out and give up otherwise. And then there's no one for the governments to go, hey, I need you to put on this event, and you've got 10 days to do it.
Well, that's also kind of what happened with like COVID. Like, you had a whole load of people leave all sectors of the events industry.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they had to. And so like that sector knowledge was still, I think now, even, you know, what are we, a year and a half on?
Yeah.
I think there's still that frantic scramble to kind of regain some of that knowledge, or upskill people to that level, but you can't regain experience. So
it's
tough. But also then I find, again, coming back to the ego, quite a lot of the time people kind of knowledge, some people, not all, some will knowledge hoard, and they're like, I know everything. I won't share any of my information with you because then you might take my job. And you're like, great, but what happens if you break your leg or, you know, your head falls off? No one else can now step in. So why aren't you building a more resilient infrastructure or network, and supporting everyone so that actually all the job can get done in the safest and most efficient way.
I remember someone told me many years ago about, like, when it comes to writing your plans, they said, I want the information I want in this plan is that if you dropped it on the floor and someone picked it up and never met you, they could deliver it. And that is how I approach my plan writing, is like very plain English. This goes here at this time. Agreed by this person.
Yep, that is what I like.
Thank you. So this has been like such an enthralling conversation, and I just love listening to all of your wisdom, and especially when it comes to like your experience. So, because I find interesting is like when people are like, oh, you're in crowd safety, you know everything. I'm like, no, I don't know everything. Like, my crowd safety is like the kind of zone X crowd safety, like the transport, like the outside of the, you know, the world. Like, one of my least experiences is actually what you're really experienced in, which is the pit side, which is what I'm really fascinated of learning more.
Come and get in a pit.
Huh?
Come and get in a pit.
Well then, yeah, I know I need to do it. That's like,
it's not something you can learn from by just watching.
I know.
You have to get in a pit.
Yes. It's the arm strength, the kind of lift and then
no arm strength. That's the beauty of it. No, all leg. Yeah. So, and this is part of it. So there'll be loads of different videos going forwards and backwards, and obviously everyone's got their own preferred method. And we're currently going through like a review of our techniques against other people's techniques, just to make sure that we are doing the best that we can. But yeah, it doesn't rely on strength. Like, the strength helps, but generally if they're crowd surfing, like, the crowd have done all the work for you, they're already up.
I guess
all you
you're kind of below them, aren't you?
Yeah, all you need to do is guide them to the floor and make sure their head is the last. Yeah, I mean, there are times where people will end up on the floor, it's inevitable. So if you've got a massively busy pit and you don't have enough staff, or it's just unexpected, they, like, the crowd surfer coming over can end up on the floor, but it's just about making sure the head is the last thing. But we try and obviously never aim for that.
That
is literally a survival mode right there.
So is it more of a technique of pivot as you guide?
No pivoting.
Oh, I just wanted to say pivot,
back.
Really.
Oh no, you can pivot if you really want. But no, it's just about getting under the shoulders. So getting under the shoulders and then a coordinated step down. And then, you know, make the person do most of the work. It's different. A crowd surf is very different to a pullout, where actually you are going to have to lift. But then hopefully you've done a lot of work in the build up to that with like the crowd at the front of the stage barrier. So they are all on your side and they basically love you. So that when it comes to lifting this person out, actually your crowd are helping. So you don't have to do all the lifting yourself. Always get the crowd on side. Yep. I've had dance-offs with members of the crowd in, like, during changeovers, trying to keep them happy. Yeah, I've not confiscated their sweets. So I've had ones that have, like, snuck sweets in past security on the front doors. And I'm like, oh, banging. Opal fruits, thank you very much. And they're like, oh, we thought you were going to confiscate them. And I was like, well, you've already got them in.
And you're feeding me.
I'm not taking responsibility for the search team. They've got their job. Ultimately, if it was a giant bag of crack, then I would take it off you. But
it might elicit a different response.
But you know, it's opal fruits. It's going to keep me happy. It's going to keep you happy. And if my crowd are happy, then it makes my job a lot easier. So,
And they
will tell you stuff, like they'll tell you what's going on as well. Because again, you can't see, you've got, you know, a crowd of 2,500 and you've got, let's go for eight people in the pit. You can't see everything that's going on, and with the density as well. So you having that good rapport, meaning that someone turns around and goes, actually, this guy behind me is being really creepy and really inappropriate. Cool. Thank you for telling us. We'll take him out and have a chat. And at bare minimum, we'll move him in the crowd so that he's not near you.
Yeah.
So
nice.
Yeah, I love the pit.
Pearls of wisdom from KT on pit security. And oh, yeah. Crowds like cows.
Crowds like cows.
Oh, I love it. Oh, thank you so much for coming on and sharing everything that you shared. I mean, I found it fascinating. So I hope that those listening also enjoyed the journey. Any parting words from you, Katie?
No, just thank you very much for having me. And hopefully this doesn't lead to a whole load of cancellations in my diary. Where everyone goes, oh my God, she's a nutter. Right, cross her off. No, oh Katie, sorry, we suddenly don't have the budget for you anymore.
Oh, I think the effect will be the other way around. I certainly have just found it fascinating, your just breadth of experience. And you know, when it comes to the kind of medical side and the security side, and now you're studying, you know, in your PhD, you know, especially with the Martin's the Protect Duty Martin's Law that's coming in, we need you now more than ever. And I personally would feel safer at any event knowing that you had a hand in some part of the planning or are there in the pit. I'll be there. Aww. And I'll bring some fruit pastels if I get it through. So
do you know what, I'll always let a fruit pastel through. Don't quote me on that, anybody. Like, oh my God,
keep her in the pit, now don't put her on search.
Yeah, I'm gonna get all these messages going, Katie, we confiscated loads of fruit pastels, they were all full of crack after your interview. I'm like, oh man.
Oh, but thank if you
do ever see me on an event site, I will always have sweets on me. So just because I walk around and hand them out, which is probably a bit weird, but
we all need that bit of sugar. We all need that bit of sugar to keep us going.
Oh,
but
yes.
No, thank you so, so much for your time and your wisdom. And I'm just very grateful to have you in this industry. And I'm very grateful to be working alongside you and hopefully working together to make this industry a safer place to work in. And to enjoy events in. So thanks again, Katie. Yes,
definitely.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and follow the show for more episodes to come. If you would like to learn more about crowd safety, you can visit my website and blog at isemurphy.com. That's isemurphy.com.